What is going on, everyone? Welcome to the Taming the Financial Chaos podcast, where we embrace uncertainty, we embrace the chaos, because we are working to establish control. My name is Matt McCoy. I'm a financial advisor and a certified financial planning professional out of Greensboro, North Carolina. The name of my practice is Principles of Financial Planning. You can find us online at principles with an L-E of financialplanning.com. That's principles with an L-E of financialplanning.com. Ladies and gentlemen, technology is coming for your job. Insert dramatic music here. I have none. How in the world are you? I hope you are doing well. All kidding aside, if today's podcast sounds a little bit different than our previous podcast, well, it should, because I am taking the liberty to enjoy some particularly beautiful weather that we are having in North Carolina today. And so I have taken the podcast outside, and it is my pleasure to have you along for the ride. In case you didn't pick up from my joke that today's topic is technology, well, then allow me to inform you, today's topic is technology. I don't think that it's any secret that we're kind of in the midst of technology taking another major leap forward in the form of our artificial intelligence. Vice President Kamala Harris has been appointed the artificial intelligence czar, whatever exactly that means. But nevertheless, when you tell someone, or when you bring up the topic that somebody's job might be in jeopardy, regardless of the reason, that has some negative connotations to it, and understandably so. But I don't think that anyone would doubt necessarily the value that technology has brought to the table. Obviously, there are plenty of things that we've been able to do thanks to technology. You know, if it weren't for technology, we wouldn't be able to accomplish them. And at the end of the day, I think it's probably fair to say that if we were to sum up the purpose of technology, you know, why it is of value in our lives, it's not just because of what we're able to accomplish with it, you know, or not accomplish without it, but it's fundamentally because we're able to get certain things done much more efficiently, which then frees us up to devote our time, effort, and energy toward other ventures. Just a quick, easy example I would give would be that of the calculator. I don't think it's a secret to anybody that the typical person is able to do a math problem, work a math problem much more quickly with a calculator as opposed to sitting down with a piece of paper and pen or pencil. So why is that? Well, one possible explanation, at least a partial explanation, would be that a machine like a calculator, it's only got one purpose. It's only got one task that it needs to accomplish. Now, you could argue that a person, when they sit down to work a math problem with a sheet of paper and pen or pencil, they only have one task to complete at that point in time. But their brain is obviously managing much more than just that one task. If we want to set aside, you know, basic biological functions, we could say that our brain, at minimum, has to make sure that when we get done with that math problem, we return to our normally scheduled lives. We can't forget we've got a whole life to get back to. What a surprise that would be if our brain allowed us to forget that. So needless to say, our brain is preoccupied with a lot, you know, much more, obviously, than the calculator. Now, I can't claim that I came up with that idea or that potential explanation all on my own. That actually came from a podcast I listened to. It was Dr. Jordan Peterson's podcast, and he had Dr. Andrew Huberman on his podcast. This was back, in case you want to look it up yourself, it's October 13th, 2022, episode 296. But Dr. Huberman is a neuroscientist out of Stanford University. And one of the things that Dr. Huberman brought up during the course of their conversation was the topic of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Now, a couple things on that. Number one, don't worry about what that is or what exactly it does. Because number two, I'm not going to worry about pronouncing that phrase again. I'm going to abbreviate it as DPC from here on out. So when you hear me say DPC, that's what I'm referring to. But nevertheless, the DPC, he brought it up because one of the things he said was if somebody had a lesion on their DPC, or if someone like Dr. Huberman were to, quote, transiently inactivate it, close quote, that the person, that individual, would become incredibly accurate at any motor task. That too is a direct quote from him. He went on to say, or went on to give the example of a shooting game. You know, so like a video game where the objective is to shoot at targets. And he said, you know, ordinarily some folks would have some hits or misses. You know, some folks would be better at it. Some folks would be worse. But if you were to inactivate the DPC, accuracy, quote, goes through the roof, close quote. And according to him, it's near 100%. Now, my interpretation of that is that he meant that it's near 100% accuracy. And if that's true, if I understood that correctly, that is remarkable, to say the least. Incredible, truly. But, he said, there's a catch. And the catch is that while you might be immensely more accurate at the game, you would be unable, so no longer would you be able to distinguish between the right target and the wrong target. So in other words, you wouldn't be able to tell friend from foe. In case it's not obvious, doesn't matter how accurate you are, if you're not hitting the right target, that's a problem. Now, that point is obviously significant on its own, but I think it's also insightful if we kind of think about, you know, the tasks that we ask machines to complete, as opposed to how our brains operate and what all they do for us. And where I would start with that is, you know, going back to the calculator, we might lament the fact that we're not as efficient as the calculator in performing math problems. But if we think about that specific scenario, so like a competition between a calculator and a human working a math problem, the metric we would use, assuming both of them get the correct answer, the metric we would use to determine the winner would be time. And so if we were to plot that on a graph, we would actually only need one axis to be able to do that. You know, and so it's purely just a matter of how quickly they can get things done. Now, if we contrast that with the shooter game, it starts to get a little interesting because the shooter game is not a simple matter of a single data point. So in other words, we couldn't plot that with one axis. And the reason for that is because it not only matters how many targets we hit, but it also matters what the nature of those targets are. In other words, have we hit the right targets or the wrong targets? You know, and like I said before, does that mean we've shot our friends or have we shot foes? Which is it? So what we can say based on that is that measuring in like a competition between a calculator and a human, measuring in that specific scenario, that's just a simple matter of quantification. So in other words, we just count essentially. And that tells us, you know, who the winner would be. But in a shooter game, we not only have quantification as an issue, but we also have quality or qualification as an issue. And that becomes our second data point. And so because of that, any graph we might use to represent the results of such a competition would look different as well. We would have two axes instead of just one. Now, what's interesting about quality, at least from my perspective, is that this would seem to be where things become exceedingly difficult for a machine to compete. To flesh this out a little bit, let's consider another hypothetical competition between man and machine, but this time let's imagine that they're competing at the shooter game we've been talking about. To be clear, though, we're not talking about maybe what could be described as the conventional understanding of man versus machine when it comes to these type of games, because typically in those scenarios, what you're really dealing with is the programming that someone has put into the game. And so what I mean by that is the game or the software, the machine, what have you, it's not actually thinking. it's just following like a pre-written list of rules or actions that have been given to it. So in other words, it's been told, hey, if the person wants to play against the machine, well, this is what the machine's going to do. So in this hypothetical competition we actually have two, let's say, entities thinking for themselves, quote unquote, the man and the machine, you know, now an artificial intelligence type machine. So if the machine is thinking for itself and we're dealing with a quality issue, as we talked about before, you know, being sure to hit the right targets, well, how does the machine know which targets are the right ones and which targets are the wrong ones? Heck, how do we know which targets are the right ones and which ones are the wrong ones? To make this a little more insightful, a little more useful, so we can apply what we're talking about here back to the real world, let's assume that the game at hand is not one that involves uniforms, you know, so like soldiers that you're shooting at or trying to avoid shooting at. You know, in that type of scenario, it's almost like you've got the answer handed to you because it's just a matter of who's wearing what uniform. Let's say instead that what we're dealing with is the right targets are criminals and the wrong targets are just everyday citizens. Well, here's something I know from my law enforcement background. Criminals and everyday citizens look identical. In other words, criminals don't wear uniforms. They certainly don't wear name tags or patches. And they certainly don't carry signs saying, hey, I'm a criminal. So how in the world are we supposed to, and how is AI supposed to, differentiate between a criminal in an everyday person? To start with, what's the difference between a criminal and an average citizen? The answer to that is probably simpler than you think, and that's just the simple fact that a criminal has committed crime and an average citizen's not. So that obviously is just a simple matter of behavior. But drawing further upon my law enforcement experience, what I can also tell you is behavior goes a long way in being able to discern or tell whether there's maybe even a crime in process. The fact that I say that behavior can go a long way to telling you whether a crime is in process, as opposed to saying that behavior absolutely tells you whether a crime is in process, means that there's two additional points here to make. First one would be there's an element of interpretation. So you have to be able to process the behavior you're seeing in front of you, you know, based on other factors like contextual clues and things of that nature. So you've got to be able to understand the behavior, not in an absolute sense, but what it means for the specific scenario that you're dealing with right in front of you. What it also means, though, is that if there is no direct link or connection that we can draw between specific behavior and, you know, what exactly that behavior means, well, it means that behavior can manifest itself in all sorts of different ways. Another way to put that would be, you know, based on what the person is engaged in at a particular moment in time, or, you know, maybe what emotion they're experiencing, you know, that can be reflected in behavior, you know, of any sort, essentially. You know, there's not necessarily one specific behavior that we can say all people exhibit for a certain thing or a certain emotion. And the significance of that is just the simple fact that that means that we've got to be able to interpret things on the fly. We've got to be equipped with the tools to do that. And it also means that there's basically an infinite amount of possibilities for what behavior we might see on display right in front of us. Something else that becomes significant about the fact that, you know, behavior is unpredictable and is so spontaneous is the simple fact that this means basically we're always learning, you know, new ways that behavior can manifest itself. It also means that we don't arrive on this planet knowing everything we need to know about behavior. And so if that's true for us, then it's certainly true for AI. But being able to say that we know something applies to AI is not the same thing as being able to say that we know how it applies to AI. And in this specific case, just like we have to learn about behavior, we know that AI has to learn about behavior as well. And really the most significant point that I'm trying to highlight here is the simple fact that there is a learning component to AI. So if AI is capable of learning in the same way that a human does, you know, as a child develops, let's say, well, then maybe the whole concern over AI being able to discern certain things is a moot point. But that would also seem to depend on just how much needs to be pre-programmed into AI. So, you know, AI is obviously a piece of software, so to speak, just like any other piece of software, in terms of the simple fact that somebody has to sit down and write it. And so the question will become, well, how much has to be handed to it in the first place? And if it's a matter of having to program all possible responses, you know, if we're talking about human behavior, well, if behavior is virtually limitless, so in other words, there are an infinite amount of possibilities that could result from a particular set of circumstances, well, that would seem to be pretty problematic in terms of AI's ability to interact and understand people, at least in a behavioral sense. Now, admittedly, I'm making some of these statements about AI out of ignorance, but I feel like I'm in pretty good company because I've certainly heard plenty of others speak on AI and plenty of others who are much more intelligent and knowledgeable about this subject matter than I am. And they haven't expressed any greater of an understanding of what's going on with AI than what I'm, you know, expressing here. And the last thing I would say here on the note of programming AI, that also raises an interesting question about who is programming AI. The reason I place emphasis on that question is specific to the financial realm. You know, obviously finances are a personal and intimate subject. And because of that, my experience has been, and understandably so, that folks want to work with people they know and trust. Well, how do you know you can trust AI? And on top of that, if you don't know who's doing the programming, how do you know you can trust them? Now, I don't want you to mistake the point I'm trying to make here. I'm not saying that we shouldn't trust AI. All I'm saying is that if we're going to trust it, then we need to have a basis for that. And at minimum, that would seem to start with understanding who's involved and how the system works. And frankly, just from the perspective that I have today, it just seems like we've got a lot of work to do in that department. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Taming the Financial Chaos podcast. Just a quick reminder that you can find more information and resources about my practice online at principles with an L-E of financialplanning.com. That's principles with an L-E of financialplanning.com. I hope you will join us next time. And until then, take care and stay healthy. Securities and investment advisory services are offered through Lincoln Financial Securities Corporation, member SIPC. Insurance is offered through Lincoln affiliates and other companies. Lincoln Financial Securities and Principles of Financial Planning are separate entities. Lincoln Financial Securities and its representatives do not offer tax or legal advice. Individuals should consult their tax or legal professionals regarding their specific circumstances.